Hi there, listener. It's Matthew. You've come looking for an episode of the Children's Book Podcast, and you've found it. Hooray! But you're probably wondering why the name of the podcast has changed. After 8 years of doing the Children's Book Podcast, I began a new career as head of podcasts at A Kids Company About, where I now oversee a podcast network dedicated to producing original content that talks up to kids, centers the things going on in their world, and engages and challenges how they see the world and themselves. All of the episodes of the Children's Book Podcast are still here, but now, if you're subscribed, you'll get new episodes of Worth Noting, a kids podcast about current events, hosted by me. Something for you and the young people in your life to enjoy together. Enjoy this episode, and I hope you'll check out Worth Noting and other podcasts from A Kids Company About. Meet Kelly DiPuccio and Greg Pezzoli. And a sleepless owl. The most beautiful cupcake. And the most terrible dragon. Welcome to All the Wonders, the Children's Book Podcast. I'm Matthew Winner. This is episode number 281 of the podcast with Kelly DiPuccio and Greg Pezzoli, author and illustrator of Dragon Was Terrible. Kelly and Greg have been on the podcast before, but this interview was actually their first time meeting. It also ended up being one of those really beautiful moments where we all were fans of one another's work. Or, more specifically, Kelly and I are perpetually impressed with the work Greg's been doing in children's book illustration, and Greg shared his love of Kelly's story through the experience of reading their book at school visits. Needless to say, I think you're going to feel right at home in their company. This conversation feels really comfortable to me. I hope you'll find it equally good company for you. Here is episode number 281 of the podcast with Kelly DiPuccio and Greg Pezzoli. Welcome to the podcast, Kelly and Greg. I'm glad I get to talk to both of you. Come on.
Hello. Hi, Matthew. Hi, Greg.
Hi. Hi. Thanks, Matthew. Hi, Kelly.
Greg, hi. Thanks for having us on, Matthew.
Yeah, I'm realizing like seconds before we started to record that you both haven't met each other. So that's exciting that we get to have first meeting over a podcast. Oh, it all started there, eh? No, but you both have been on here before, and you're both individually people that I admire a whole lot. So how great that you have books coming out together that are, I mean, Dragon, come on, Dragon, your Dragon book is amazing, and it might be one of the reasons why I'm like seriously excited to get back to school. I've got a stack of books that are waiting to share, but Dragon Was Terrible is at the top of the list, and I'm not even kidding about that.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. We had a lot of fun. Well, as I know, I had a lot of fun writing it. I can't speak for Greg, but...
It was awful. It was terrible.
It was terrible.
It was a terrible, terrible experience.
I poured myself into these illustrations. Oh, that's great. The feel of it, too, Greg, since the very first time I read it, and this is a lot, too, with... Kelly, you've got text that every once in a while like winks out at the reader, and I like that a lot. And your illustration style, Greg, is the way I've come to sort of know you, in that I always pull from this memory of watching Rocky and Bullwinkle, and right. Your character designs, for whatever reason, for me, just have like an emotional connection to that for me. But this felt like in that way, then taking that to the next level, this felt like a Rocky and Bullwinkle short. And I like that. I really enjoyed that. So there's that.
Yeah, I'm a huge Rocky and Bullwinkle fan, particularly, you know, Jay Ward, the illustrator animator. And I think my favorite part of the Rocky and Bullwinkle and Friends show was always the fractured fairy tales, which I guess this is kind of like one of those. So anyway, yeah, I appreciate that. I don't really think too much about those shows anymore, but I loved those as a kid, and as a teenager, I watched them too.
I think for me, it was something like I haven't thought about them, but being in children's literature the way that I am and reading these stories, and it just sort of has been churning up those memories in my childhood and drawing from some of those early experiences, which is just, it's a fun place to live. And it's fun too, Kelly, to see you, having talked to you, I feel like recently enough to talk about Gaston. That wasn't that long ago that we talked, but to see your voice come out so differently across what you're reading or what you're writing, from Everyone Loves Bacon to Gaston to, yeah, just everything is just, you've got, I know that you know how much I adore your use of puns. You and Sam Berger, I you're my go-tos for that. But
thank you. Yeah, it's funny. It's always a surprise to me with each book and story, the voice that comes out, because I'm just as surprised as everybody else. Like Dragon was terrible.
Wait, this... you're surprised at the voice that comes out when you write a manuscript? That is mind-blowing. I love that.
It's true. It That's really is so true. Cool. Because each one just kind of takes on a life of its own. And I'm never quite sure how that's going to look. And like with Dragon Was Terrible, this actually started because Greg had this illustration on his website of a dragon. And our editor, Janine O'Malley, saw the dragon and she really liked the look and the character. And she, you know, asked if there could be a story there. And so I just kind of sat there looking at this dragon and waiting for, you know, it to speak to me. And so, you know, some stories just come out in rhymes, some come out with a strong voice, some, there's no rhyme or reason to how the story begins to tell itself. I just, you know, hear it in my head. So this one came out with a very strong voice, and he was not such a nice guy, but it's funny because in the picture that Greg drew, he looks very friendly, but apparently this dragon had a little bit darker side, so.
That's funny. I sort of forgot about the origin of that, but I have that that original dragon. I have like a little framed version of it sitting, like I had a show where it was in, and I just have it sitting here next to my bookshelf. Mm-hmm. And so that's right. That drawing, Janine, went to you for a story, and then you, I feel like pretty quickly, wrote a story, and then it was amazing. And then it came back to me as a manuscript, and it was a super unique experience for me too. To say like, well, here's this character who I came up with for whatever reason to make a drawing, make a screen print out of it, and then you know, when it came back as Kelly's story, it was a fully formed, you know, three dimensional, so to speak, character, completely, you know, her own. So then it came back to me to try to like reinterpret it. It was super interesting, actually, the process, how that happened.
I can imagine to draw. I mean, I picture you in Greg, you've designed so many like fun buttons and t-shirts, right? I think a lot of us in the library world know you for these like great read buttons you make and things like that. And so many of us have the banned Books Week shirt that you have that you've designed, but to have it go from just a sketch, a character design that you made, perhaps not even intending for it to be a story, but just like exercising your creative juices for the day, and then to have a story come back that way is just, it is a neat experience. I feel like it's, I don't know. I'm glad that it was what it was. I'm glad that it was Kelly that got the art, and I'm glad that Kelly brought back the story to you and it worked.
Well, you know, this book really is like a perfect example of great collaboration because, you know, Janine fell in love with this sketch and this dragon. But I think our agent, because both Greg and I work with Stephen Malk, I think he may have suggested me for the story. So then he kind of paired me up with it. And then also then Janine, I worked with her on the ending. This particular book had, I think, like 3 or 4 different endings. I wish I had like the outtakes, you know, so we could see all the different endings. But so she really played a big role in wrapping it up. And so it was just kind of like, I don't know, it just kind of all came together. And I have to say it, you know, even though there were a lot of people involved, it just kind of, we all kind of did our own thing and was our own strength, you know, and it came together. So I think it's a lot of fun.
I think it was executed really well. So you didn't have a whole lot of communication then back and forth directly, or maybe any at all, did you?
No, we really didn't. When Greg finally saw the manuscript, it was pretty much done.
I feel like maybe I saw one iteration and then, but then the ending changed. I don't know. I feel like maybe there was an iteration where there was a little girl in the story.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But you know, I was really happy with sort of the voice that Kelly has. It's like it just feels very much like a classic picture book to me, and that's kind of what I tried to bring to the pictures too. Just a not necessarily like a vintage look or feel, but just more of like a quote unquote classic picture book or storybook kind of feeling than maybe some of the other books that I've done.
Well, there is that quality to the, even just the palette you employed in your art, Greg, that it feels a little, not vintage, but it feels a little washed out. It feels like the primary colors that you're employing here are like, are like a cantaloupe orange and yellows and browns and grays.
It
gives it a different, I mean, I feel like it feels in that great way, like an older book. And then to have the voice be as comfortable as it is, Kelly, to have it. Okay. Do you mind if I read to you? Can I read to you? Is that all right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm gonna read to you. Here's the beginning of the story. Listeners, I'm not, I'm like, Kelly, you don't need me to read your own book to you. Dragon was terrible. Naturally, dragons have a bit of terrible in them, because they're dragons, after all. But this dragon here? Super terrible. He stomped on flowers, he played tricks on the guards, and he spit on cupcakes. Who does that? Dragon. That's who. Your voice is so comfortable in that. And by that I mean, too, as someone reading it aloud, within reading the first page or two, I immediately fell right into what voice you were trying to establish there. So I guess I get then the way you're saying, Kelly, that the voice, however you said, the voice sort of spoke to you when you were writing this manuscript. It told you, because it feels like there is a narrator telling this story, and that it's my job just to sort of keep up and try to say the words fast enough.
Well, and that's kind of how I feel sometimes when I write, you know, I just listen to the narrator and I'm just a scribe, which is pretty awesome when it happens that way. Because those are the best stories, you know, when the ones that kind of come from, I don't know where they come from, but it's wonderful when it happens.
Do you, would you mind, Kelly, being that you wrote this story from Greg's illustration, would you mind sort of summing up the story for those listening, just so we're not running only off of that quote? I would do it, but I would love to hear your take on it first.
Well, I he's a terrible dragon. We've kind of established that. And so the king would, he wants to tame, obviously, this terrible dragon because he's wreaking havoc on the village. And so everybody gives their shot at trying to tame the dragon, and the knights do, and the blokes and the lassies do, and everybody's failing miserably at this task. And so finally a very bright, creative young lad comes up with the idea to sketch a story. And so it's through this great story that this kid has come up with, that he kind of lures this terrible dragon in. And I don't know if I should give away, you know, what happens, but that's kind of the premise. It's just about taming this terrible dragon that's causing all kinds of trouble. And Greg's illustrations are hilarious, kind of funny, because I've learned to really let go over the years. You know, not that I feel like I ever really micromanaged, but now I really totally trust the illustrators just to put the sentence out there and just know that they're going to have fun with it. And it's really my favorite part of this job now is seeing what illustrators come up with. And so it's a lot of fun, the book, in terms of, you know, all the mayhem that's going on with the knights and the different villagers, and the castle gets teepeed.
I was going to say, that's Jonah's favorite part, is when they teepee the castle. Even when they teepee the castle, and then at the page turn, the villagers have enough, and we're ready then for the village, for the pronouncement that's pasted to the wall of the castle, where the king is asking someone to come forth. Now it's the people asking to come forth. And Greg, you just have this bizarre cast of characters. Like, there's a an executioner and a someone playing the lute and a wizard or something. I just remember that they stare right out at you as if to say, like, okay, reader, which one of us is going to solve it, or are you going to get in here and solve this problem too? It just,
well, they've had enough. You know,
yeah, yes. They have. There's lots of hands on hips. They absolutely had enough.
Well, one of the things that, you know, I've been able to do is I have read this because I finished the art for this some time ago. I feel like maybe I finished it like the end of last summer, something like that. So I've been able to read it at school visits and just say, like, this book's coming out next year. And it is such a great read aloud. And that's one of my favorite parts, is when you can say the villagers had enough, and then you get all the kids to say enough with you, and they all yell enough. And there's kind of a third time that you expect that they're going to say enough, but they don't, which always kind of trips the kids up. So it works super great as a read aloud. It's a lot of fun to read, and then to pick apart the little maybe unsaid things in the illustrations, like there's like graffiti on the castle that says dragon was here, and then a couple pages later it's like dragon was here again. Little tiny things you might not notice the first time you read it.
And my favorite, don't forget my favorite graffiti, king is a baby.
King is a baby. Well,
that just slays me every time I see that.
My favorite one is is actually on the back cover of the book. It's the poster that says "See Dragon, Say Dragon."
Nice.
You know, I had to explain that one to somebody, but you know, I just see those posters every time I'm at an Amtrak station. So.
Yeah. See something. I didn't even notice that before. I'm like noticing it for the first time. Oh my word! I want to ask you first, Kelly, and then I want to talk about stuff that Greg hides in art, because I feel like, Greg, there was a little bit of an online contest going with stuff you hid in Goodnight Owl. So I want to talk about records in a second. But
yeah.
Kelly, I'm positive I said this to you before, but your books read aloud so well. They do. How do you get them to read aloud well? And I don't mean like tell us your secret. I more mean is your approach to read it aloud to kids a lot, to read aloud to yourself? Like where do you find you get the best mileage out of being able to edit down your words and find that flow?
You know, I think in part because I've been doing this a long time, you know, going on 20 years dating myself, but I think after
you started writing when you were six?
Yeah, isn't that amazing? Yeah. I should talk to my first grade teacher. I think I've internalized it so much so that I can totally self-edit now.
Okay.
In terms of I don't know. Like I said, I hear the voice, I write it down, and then I just, you just know when it's getting cumbersome. And because I do a lot of school visits and I read a lot to the kids in large groups, you know when you're getting too wordy and your books are too long because, you know, they get squirmy. And so over the years, I've really learned to just, you know, pull back and less is more, you know, so.
I picture, like, if I place myself in me, like, writing a lesson for teaching. I've been teaching for 12 years, and there's a point now where I know how long things are going to take. I know the pacing. You don't need to think about it anymore. It becomes, what do you call that, like, secondhand? It becomes, like, muscle memory.
Yeah, yeah.
Got it. That makes sense. Cool. Well, I mean, again, your first grade teacher. Mad props to that. Greg, I remember when
it does read aloud so well too. You know, whenever I read it and I say, and he spits on cupcakes, like I just wait for the pause of the gasp where all the kids go, ew! Right? Everybody in the audience freaks out a little bit.
And everybody freaks out. I don't know if you've noticed this, but when he takes candy from the baby unicorns, I mean, there's like this audible gasp in the audience. So like, you know, like that's really crossing the line.
Right.
It's so funny to hear the reactions to that.
Ah, oh, yeah. The nerve from a unicorn.
A baby unicorn.
When I read to my son, I've read it a couple times, and he always says, "Where's the mommy unicorn at the end of the story?" when they have a regrouping of the characters. But where's the mommy? It's okay, buddy. It's all okay now.
Oh, she was eaten by the dragon.
She was, yeah.
Yeah.
But he's cool with the kid now. We're good.
Well, Greg, I think we should actually do a follow-up book and call it, like, Revenge of the Baby Unicorns. Isn't that just, like, a great title?
Already the title.
The title sells it. Revenge of the Baby Unicorns. I love it. There you go. And all the wonders
exclusive.
You get
the movie right, sold by Wednesday.
So, Greg, I don't know why I'm not connecting this, but, well, first I was going to say, I remember when I first talked to you way back when, and we talked about the watermelon seed and how when you, if I remember right, when you originally wrote that manuscript, it was long. You had to cut a lot of words out of it to get it down to the, whatever the number is, like 30 or 50 words that are in it, right? That was an experience that you went through.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I think the final Watermelon Seed is 140 or 141. Not unique words, but total words.
But where I was
going to... I think the first draft was like 2,500.
That's,
and it included an emergency room sequence. There's a presentation I give sometimes when I'm, but not when I'm talking to little kids, but when I'm talking to older students about writing, or sometimes to teachers about my writing process, and I show them some of the early drafts. And so one of the lines that I cut, I know, was it was like, "Well, we'll have to cut you open," the first doctor said.
Jeez.
That got cut out maybe around like draft four somewhere.
It lasted a couple drafts. That's amazing.
Do they pump its stomach as well?
Yeah. Oh,
I yes. I don't want to give it too much away.
No,
you know, I could still write a sequel at some point. So.
That's right. We want to make sure that we still have time for like taking the spoon of Ipecac and inducing vomiting and all that for the children's book. We need more of the.
We need more relatable characters. <That's, you know? laughs>
Oh, gross. Greg, I was going to say, though, when Kelly was talking, that I wasn't connecting, but it makes sense that you then have that unique experience of the illustrator who at times illustrates other people's stories that then you get to go around and share, like you're saying, with Kelly's text to this book. You're sharing a book that that it's not your words, that it's, I mean, that's a cool thing to be able to go through that. I'm sure Kelly, you do the same thing where it's, and look at this thing that Greg illustrated here, and look at these other
right.
things, but.
Well, because it's never my pictures.
No, but to think of it from the other side of it not being your words. I don't know why. It's just something I hadn't thought about that experience before.
I think of that, you know, sometimes, you know, in terms of illustrators who are also the authors, you know, and how they feel about doing their own books versus other people's books, you know.
Greg, how do you feel about doing your own books versus other people's books?
I don't know. I mean, I
it's a different process, right?
I mean, I think that early on, you know, my first book came out 3 years ago, so I haven't been doing this that long. And I think early on, I was very happy to have the two books that I had done to read. And, you know, when I was doing school visits and stuff. And I think that I get excited about whatever it is I'm working on at the time. And I think I actually was able to read to a couple kids at a library in Philly. I think I read Dragon Was Terrible when it was still like pencil sketches. Which is something I've started to do with my own books, too. I did that a lot with Goodnight Owl, where I know this isn't really answering your question. It's a little tangential. But where I can sort of, like as Kelly was saying, she will sort of gauge from the audience that maybe she's losing them a little bit if something's a little too wordy. I can kind of do a similar thing with the pictures too. Like maybe I need something more here for them to figure out what's actually going on, or maybe I can cut all this text out because they don't need it at all. I like reading other people's stuff. I always give the author credit. I always read I always let them know that Kelly wrote it.
You don't just like pull your index finger over her name.
I have it blacked out in the PDF. I just
oh no. But when you write and illustrate books, do both parts come together at the same time versus like in this case where you're handed a manuscript and you're developing art from that? Or do you also work from writing a manuscript and then approaching the illustrations?
I usually start with the writing. I have like maybe a sketchbook that has a character that keeps coming up a lot. So I maybe will be writing a story thinking that like it will be this character's story. But my first drafts of stories are typically Word documents, and I write them sort of in page breaks, and then I worry about the pictures as part of the next phase. So very similar to when I get a manuscript that someone else has written, and I've been tasked to make the pictures for the same, similar kind of process.
Right on. Okay, so Goodnight Owl. Let's talk about Goodnight Owl. Kelly, have you read Goodnight Owl yet?
No, I actually haven't. I need to get a copy.
It's wonderful. Can I tell you, Kelly, about Goodnight Owl? Greg, can I tell you the story of Goodnight Owl?
Please. I guess it depends on where you go with that, but yeah,
no,
sure.
No, because I have read this book to children before the end of the school year last year, and it was fun to be able to read. I had a folded and gathered copy, and it was fun to be able to read this story. And then it came out by the end of the year. I think we had a copy in our library, right? It's been out for the summer.
Yeah, like maybe mid-April or early April. Yeah.
So it's had some time for readers to connect with it. I love that you've got basically a story of an owl that wants to go to bed that keeps hearing a squeak. And then sort of in a Monty Python type style starts tearing apart his house, trying to figure out the source of the noise. Edgar Allan Poe, right? It's like the Telltale Heart, only it's an
people
owl.
Have compared it to the Telltale Heart.
I can see that.
To me, I think it's so funny that you can like nail the. You are very perceptive in a way that throws me a little bit, because you know you had that Rocky and Bullwinkle reference earlier in our conversation, and I literally have a postcard of John Cleese on my desk.
Really?
In front of my computer right now. Like I am a huge Python fan, huge Cleese in particular fan. Yeah. And so I don't know. You're not in my head, so you're able to see the influences a little more clearly than me. But I just think it's so funny that you, you did that twice in one conversation.
Well, I've come aware of the idea that, like, everything sort of points to who we are. There's all these things that we that are acting in our subconscious, and that's sort of the magic of how stories come to us. I know Kelly was talking about, like, sitting down and not knowing when a story is going to come or what it'll be, and likewise with you with your sketchbook. But this story, to me, when I read it, it kept going back. I kept having this experience in front of children of, oh, I don't think you know the reference that I'm experiencing when I read this book to you, but we're connecting in a way that is sort of unspoken. So I like reading it to the, yeah, it's a fun read aloud. It's good.
Oh, thanks.
You did a good job.
Thank you. I wanted to make a, if I can talk on it for just a minute, please. I wanted to make a weird book. I started out saying, like, I want to make something strange. And I had this idea for this owl who goes for a walk in the woods at night, and he finds this, I sort of won't get into it because it doesn't make any sense. That's why it wasn't the book. But I also was having this experience. I was on tour, and I was having this experience of reading my other books that all have little references to my previous books in them. Like in Goodnight Owl, there's a little Eiffel Tower on the shelf referencing Tricky Vic, my nonfiction book. And kids love to, like, point that stuff out. They love to shout it out. In Number One Sam, the crocodile from the watermelon seed is driving a car, and he's got watermelon on his car. Like, they love that stuff.
And it's like Easter eggs. They like that, yeah.
Yeah, and they're always interrupting my reading to say, that's a crocodile. Like, that's him. He's got watermelon on his car. And I kind of had this idea, too, that I wanted to make something where it was my intent that they would want to yell out during the story time, that it wouldn't be a very quiet story time or read aloud.
Of course. I don't know why I never saw it that way, Greg. You're making the kids, you have a character in plain view that's making the squeaking noises, but Owl doesn't see.
Yeah, and that's what's so infuriating to the kids, right? Like, that's that's what drives them crazy. When I read this to kids at story times or at schools or whatever, they're livid. The first part of the book, there's this idiot. Can you not see that there's this mouse right here? Like, they're so angry. Like, maybe they start out being like know-it-alls, like, it's a mouse, seen it, I got it, it's a mouse. And then as the owl keeps going, they're just, it's a mouse, they're pounding, you know. And I think maybe at the point when he starts ripping the floorboards up in his living room, they ease back a little bit and they say, all right, obviously this guy is crazy, I'm just going to watch this show. Like, I'm just going to see what happens here. And so it's super fun as a read aloud, just to see how engaged they get with it, because, you know, I think, as you know, most kids just like to feel like they can one up an adult, they can one up a character, you know, they're just like smarter than the owl in that circumstance. And it's a lot of fun, particularly in a group setting, I guess, a read aloud.
I could see that. That seems like a lot of fun. And I was saying before recording that we have this game where we play how many times can I bring up Carter Higgins on the podcast. And she knows it. But I was saying to you that this particular book has been brought up a lot in library circles because your case cover is so unique. And you told me the greatest story about, I should say, for those that haven't seen it, or maybe for those people I should back up that don't know what a case cover is, when you remove the jacket from the book, the case cover is the actual, like, hard cover of the book. And you have, in this case, different art on your case cover on the front and on the back than what the jacket is. So those in libraries might never see this art underneath, because often the way that the books are processed, they kind of glue on the jacket so you don't see underneath.
Right. Unless the kids rip those off.
Oh, I was going to go the other totally way, do. Which my kids do, which is totally fine. They bend the spine backwards so they can see underneath it. But it's okay. So your the art that's on the case cover, Greg, could you talk a little bit about that and about about its origin?
Yeah, sure. Thanks. Like I said before, this book, you know, for months and months and months, I was trying to write this weird story about this owl taking a walk in the woods. And, you know, kind of slamming my head against the wall. And it's one of those days where I just sat down and wrote it. I wrote it in the morning. I think I said, all right, well, this is as good as it's going to get. I sent it to my editor that afternoon, and it was pretty quick. It happened very quickly. And in that same day, I had the idea for the case cover. I'm not sure what I had for breakfast that day, but I should try to do it again.
Yeah, no kidding.
And the idea for the case cover is that there is a picture hanging in Al's house. In the interior of the book, in the illustrations, you see his living room at one point, and on the wall, there's a little framed cross stitch that says Home Sweet Home, just like hanging on his wall. And the case cover is an actual real life cross stitch that I designed the pattern for in Illustrator and sent to my editor, Rotem Moskovich at Disney Hyperion. And she cross stitched it, and then I scanned it in and color separated it for the case cover. And the front of the case is the front of the cross stitch. It's very neat and tidy. It says Home Sweet Home, and it's very neat and well articulated. And if you flip over to the back of the case cover, it's the back of the cross stitch, and it's all messy, and there are threads everywhere. And Rotem really had struggled with it, I think. She likes to cross stitch, and I think it's a point of pride for cross stitchers that the back is as tidy as the front. This is what I've sort of gleaned, that this is like, yeah, you don't want to like have a messy back because it's kind of embarrassing. And I was like, no, it has to be messy. It has to be, because that by the end of it, he's destroyed his house. So we have to, speak to that a little bit. So I had that idea for the case cover that same day. And I think I said like, P.S., do you know how to cross stitch or something? And she really came through. And we actually, we haven't released it yet, but I think sometime soon we have the cross stitch pattern. I think Disney Hyperion has it, and their design team is going to release it at like ALA and places like that. So librarians can then take the pattern and do that cross stitch if they'd like.
That's so great.
That's awesome.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And I love the idea that you turned in a manuscript to Rotem and were like, if this is good, I need you to do this cross stitch for me. She totally came through with it. Ah, that's so great.
Yeah, I remember she wrote back, like, I love that you're thinking about the cross stitch already. let me talk to acquisitions.
Ay, ay, ay. And then, Kelly, if I hop over to you, because we last, because you also have a book coming out. Well, I guess Goodnight Owl came out in April, but you, Kelly, have another book on your own coming out right after Dragon Was Terrible, which is to say that you have a sequel to Everyone Loves Bacon coming out. Everyone Loves Cupcake. Yeah. Come on now.
Yes, Everyone Loves Cupcake is coming out. I believe September 9th is the release date. And yeah, I'm really excited about it. Yeah, Eric White is the illustrator again, of course. And it's pretty funny. I actually think it's a little bit funnier than Bacon. It's a very different story.
Yeah, in Bacon there was this self-absorbed main character that everyone was cool with Bacon, but Bacon was a little too cool with himself.
Yeah, Bacon is pretty much a jerk. And Cupcake is very sweet. Haha, I like to joke about that. Yeah, so it's she's like a perfectionist, I guess is a good way of putting it. And I know people like Cupcake. Not myself, of course, but I'm excited to see what people think of it. And it's funny when Greg, you were talking about the little nods and illustrations.
Yeah.
Because in Everyone Loves Cupcake, on the milk carton, there is a picture of Bacon missing. Which is just hilarious. So yeah, that comes out next month, and I'm really excited about it.
It's a lot of fun, and it's got like on the same page, because I had it open because I was talking about your puns earlier, and on that same page is where your text says, "Coffee loved cupcake, a latte." Says the text bubble, "Cake loved cupcake, I do," and it's a wedding cake. That's the best. I mean, there's so many in that. Same with Everyone Loves Bacon. There's so many beats there where you could read this story in like under 5 minutes, but the real opportunity here is to just stop and milk it and let the kids really let all the beats hit with the kids. It's really great.
Yeah, it's pretty corny.
It's fantastic, especially because there's a fortune cookie that like communicates through all of the.
Wise the fortune wise, cookie. Yeah. I'm really excited though because I found this company online that I'm going to do like custom.
Oh gosh.
Fortune cookies for giveaways for book signings, and so I can't wait for that. Adorable. See, that comes out next month, and then I have Antoinette coming out in February of next year. So everybody's kind of looking forward to that, follow up book to guest on. And
that'll be beautiful. I think I've only seen the cover, but it's Christian. I mean, Christian Robinson is such a talented artist, and the work he did on Gaston was so beautiful. So great to get one for Antoinette.
Yeah, I feel so fortunate to have some books with him because his art is just beautifully charming and sweet and just has such a great heart. And Antoinette it was kind of a challenge, and I wanted to create a unique story for the character. And I didn't want to just like retell Gaston's story, you know, from a different point of view, although I did consider that. But I felt like, you know, I needed to write her own story. So it was a little bit of a challenge in that I know the expectations were going to be really high, and I wanted to do her justice. But I think we did. And it's a fun story and a little bit of an adventure through the streets of Paris. And so
well, congratulations on that.
Thank you.
And you both, to sort of bring this conversation to a close, you both mentioned a lot of names today of people that you're working with, and I know that there's a thread running through them because I've talked to them before, but Stephen Malk represents a lot of you, most of you. I know he does of Mac and you both and Eric and Christian as well, right? Is that part of what helps facilitate the opportunity to be able to work together?
I think so.
Who knows? But whatever it's awesome that it happens.
Yeah. Steve is really a genius when it comes to having the sensibility about pairing stories with the perfect artist. So a lot of times I'll submit something and he just immediately knows, you know, who would be perfect for that story, or he will, you know, put two people together. And so, he really knows the business inside and out and has tremendous instincts. So I trust him implicitly, you know. And I, so I don't know. That. Yeah, I don't know if Kelly Greg wants to add to that, but.
Do I trust Steve?
he doesn't listen, Greg. Yeah. It's fine. You can say whatever you want. It's a safe place here, Greg.
He does listen, actually.
I know he does.
I think, I'm sure it's just easier. You know, Steve, my impression is that he just sort of knows everybody, and he's been in the business for so long, and he knows so many people that he can sort of see personality types and who's going to line up with what. And I'm glad that he put Kelly and I together because I really love this book, and I'm really proud of the work that we did. And it was a, you know, I think it was a true collaboration. Not that we were like calling each other every day and working together on it, but I really feel just the idea that the drawing started something that I just made. Kelly completely made it her own amazing thing, and then it came back to me to try to live up to the story she wrote. And I don't think that without Steve, that definitely would have never happened. So
I think the same thing. And I think I think that the pairing was really a wise choice, and a lot like the testament of going into publishing, knowing as an author only to trust the process, because the people, the agents that are at work and the editors that are at work and all the hands that you could be working with really do know people. And it's really the strength of how well they get your story and they get your art to pair those. I talked to Steve actually twice on record on this podcast, and the thing that I admire so much about him is his ability also to see talent in people that aren't already working in picture books. Well, I mean, he brought Eric on to writing picture books before Eric was writing picture books, and to have somebody like Carson Ellis come in and be doing picture books, things like that, I admire a lot about Steve. But Greg, actually, the reason why his name was even in my head at all, and this, the question I was trying to lead with that I distracted myself from, was that in Goodnight Owl, when Owl tears apart his bookshelves and you see his record collection laying everywhere, and when you first shared this book with me, you said, yeah, a couple of people have been trying to guess all the records, and I wonder how many you already know. And right away, it made me think of Steve. I worked at a record store for a bunch of years as I was working through college, and I know that Steve and I both, and I think you and I both, share a really similar musical taste. So to see those records laying out on the floor and to go like, oh, I owned like at least half of those.
It was hard. It was hard for me to. Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, I think it was like, you know, they're mostly punk records. There's like some Britpop there as well. But I think it was just one of those things where I didn't want to make the records too obscure, because then people wouldn't really have they're already like drawn kind of loose, so that, you know, they're just like their mind. They're not just like copied or whatever. But I wanted people to be able to recognize them, or there'd be a chance that people would recognize them. People on Facebook have kind of like taken it on their own and have just said like, that's a Fugazi record, that's a Lightning Bolt record, that's a Nirvana record. And they just, it's cool. It's a lot of fun to see it. I actually have another book coming out next year that someone else wrote that has some records in it. And I just like couldn't resist. And I did a similar guessing game with different records too.
I like it. So. I'm glad you did. I think that that's fun. And that, for me, as the adult reading to my child and reading to students, reminds me that you're writing not just for your young readers, but also for those of us that are reading to those young readers. So I really liked that quality of it as well.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, I definitely, first and foremost, I'm writing for kids, with kids in mind. But I think that particularly in the books that I write myself to, I'm also sort of, trying to make it personal for my life, like at that point in time. So those records were all sort of records that I listened to at a very particular moment of my life.
Yeah.
That I was just trying to like encapsulate. Even in Dragon Was Terrible, I did a little thing where the knights are sort of lining up to take on the dragon. One of the knights is wearing a digital wristwatch, and the time he has on his wristwatch is the street address of my studio.
My gosh.
I don't know that I'm going to be at this studio for that much longer. I might be moving studios kind of soon, so I wanted to like just put a little thing in there, like, at this point in my life, this is where I was at. And that's not going to mean anything necessarily to anybody else.
But it means something to you.
There's a little tiny thing in there that's just for me. Yeah.
That's beautiful. That idea of a time capsule like that. Yeah. All right. Well, let me end this chat tonight. Thank you both for making great books. You really, I am a big fan of you both, and
thanks for reading
them.
Yeah, it's really great.
We're all very lucky to have.
We're a big fan of you as well, so thank you.
You keep writing, and I'll keep championing. That's what I do.
if I ever have a podcast on the floor in one of my books, that there will definitely be. I don't know if they'll do All the Wonders. I'll go old school and do Let's Get Busy, people know I'm a true fan. Before it got really cool, I was on board.
Well, thank you for referencing the podcast before it was cool. That's very nice. I love it. All right. Well, Greg, I'm going to ask you this question, and then I'm going to leave Kelly for the final say afterward. But I want to bring our conversation to close back to the children that you do write for. And so this is a message that we can share to them. I'm going to see a library full of children soon. And Greg, I'd love to know what message you would like for me to bring to them from you.
Okay. Well, I think that Dragon was terrible. Ultimately, is about this guy who's kind of a bully, and maybe he just needed someone to sort of figure out what made him tick or relate to him in some way. And so I think, you know, if you see someone in the school or on the playground getting bullied, you should definitely try to stick up for the kid that is getting bullied. You should, you know, make sure that that's not happening to the best of your ability. But you should also maybe try to reach out to the kid that's doing the bullying too, and see if maybe they need a friend that day too. So that's what I would say.
Thank you, Greg. Kelly, what message would you like for me to bring to the children from you?
Well, first of all, I'll say that is great, Greg. That's a great, great message. Well, you know, my message would be to them is that, and it's funny that you kind of touched on this earlier, Greg. I wrote down, the world needs your weirdness. The world needs your weirdness, because I think that's what, you know, and by that I mean, what makes you unique, and what kind of unique story are you going to tell, or music are you going to create, or art are you going to create, or what kind of friend are you going to be? And so I think that, you know, when you can get in touch and be comfortable with who you are and your own unique voice and wherever that comes from, and just share that. And like Cookie says in Everyone Loves Cupcake, be true, be you.
This podcast is recorded and produced by me, Matthew Winner, in my library studio in Ellicott City, Maryland. You can subscribe to the podcast and access the archive of over 250 episodes at All the Wonders, a home for readers to discover new books and to experience the stories they love in wondrous ways. Go beyond the book at allthewonders.com and check out other podcasts from All the Wonders, including the Picture Booking Podcast with Nick Patton, a semi-weekly podcast about picture books and the people who make them. Our theme music is by Emily Arrow. All views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the individuals, myself included, and do not reflect ideas or viewpoints of the publishers of the books referenced. Listeners, if the episode connected with you, I'd love to hear it. Leave a comment on allthewonders.com or rate this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher through stars or reviews. Sharing the podcast with friends through Facebook and Twitter, word of mouth, or any other means helps reach more listeners, which leads to more content and more amazing guests. And that's a very good thing indeed. Coming up on the podcast, Mrs. P visits to talk about her annual Be a Famous Writer contest, and to say some incredible words about writers and writing. See you then, and thanks for listening. We know you value what you put in front of your kids, especially when it comes to screens and podcasts. That's why we're excited to share a new podcast from our friends at Sleepiest, creating bedtime stories to help your kids fall asleep fast.
Hello, Abby here. If you've got children and find bedtime's a struggle, I'd like to tell you about Coco Sleep, a children's story podcast designed to make bedtime a dream. Coco Sleep turns a chaotic bedtime into cozy bonding time. The stories are delivered in a pace that gently slows. Rumour has it that no one's ever heard an ending. So search Coco Sleep on your favourite podcast app and let's make bedtime a dream. That's K-O-K-O Sleep, and I'll see you there.